Then there was the pump act for the Artesian well, the big cement act, where Judge Miller's boys took their morning punch and kept cool for the hot afternoon. And over the strait in Maine, Buck ruled. Here he was born, and here he has lived the 4 years of his life. It was true there were other dogs. There could not but be other dogs in so vast a place, but they did not count. They came and went, resided in the populous kennels, or lived obscurely in the recesses of the house after the fashion of Toots, the Japanese pug, or Isabel, the Mexican hairless. Rarely put nose out of doors or set foot to the ground. On the other hand, there were the fox terriers, a score of them at least, who yelped fearful promises at Toots and Isabel looking out of the windows at them and protected by a legion of housemaids armed with brooms and mops. But Buck was neither house dog nor kennel dog. The whole realm was his. He plunged into the swimming tank or went hunting with the judge's sons. He escorted Molly and Alice, the judge's daughters, on long twilight or early morning rambles. On wintry nights, he lay at the judge's feet before the roaring library fire. He carried the judge's grandsons on his back, or rolled them in the grass, and guarded their footsteps through wild adventures down to the fountain in the stable yard, and even beyond where the paddocks were in the berry patches. Among the terriers, he stalked them curiously, and Toots and Isabel he utterly ignored, for he was king. King over all creeping, crawling, flying things of Judge Miller's place, humans included. His father, Elmo, the huge Saint Bernard, had been the judge's inseparable companion, and Buck bid fair to follow in the way of his father. He was not so large. He weighed only 140 pounds, for his mother, Shep, had been a Scotch shepherd dog. Nevertheless, 140 pounds, to which was added the dignity that comes of good living and universal respect, enabled him to carry himself in right royal fashion. During the 4 years since his puppyhood, he had lived the life of a sated aristocrat. He had a fine pride in himself. Was he the also in his fandom, he had one besetting weakness: faith in the system. And this made his damnation certain. But the poor system requires money. While the wages of a gardener's helper do not lap over the needs of a wife and numerous progeny. The judge was at a meeting of the Raisin Growers Association, and the boys were busy organizing an athletic club on the memorable night of Manuel's treachery. No one saw him. fooling sheep had led him along. And in the morning, four men entered and picked up the crate. More tormentors popped beside it. But they were evil-looking creatures, ragged and unkempt. And he stormed and raged at them through the bars. No one laughed and poked sticks at him, which he promptly assailed with his teeth, till he realized that was what they wanted, whereupon he lay down sullenly and allowed the crate to be lifted into a wagon. Then he and the crate in which he was imprisoned began a passage through many hands. Clerks in the express office took charge of him. He was carted about in another wagon. A truck carried him with an assortment of boxes and parcels upon a ferry steamer. He was trucked off the steamer into a great railway depot. And finally, he was deposited in an express car. For 2 days and nights, this express car was dragged along at the tail of shrieking locomotives. For 2 days and nights, Buck neither ate nor drank. In his anger, he had met the first advances of the express messengers with growls, and they had retaliated by teasing him. When he flung himself against the bars, quivering and frothing, they laughed at him and taunted him. They growled and barked like detestable dogs, mewed and flapped their arms and crowed. It was all very silly, he knew, but therefore the more outraged was dignity, and his anger waxed and waxed. He did not mind the hunger so much, but the lack of water caused him severe suffering and fanned his wrath to fever pitch. For that matter, high-strung and finely sensitive, the ill treatment had flung him into a fever, which was fed by the inflammation of his parched and swollen throat and tongue. He was glad for one thing. The rope was off his neck. That had given them an unfair advantage, but now that it was off, he would show them. They would never get another rope around his neck. Upon that, he was resolved. For 2 days and nights, he neither ate nor drank, and during those 2 days and nights of torment, he accumulated a fund of wrath that boded ill for whoever first fell foul of him. His eyes turned bloodshot, and he was metamorphosed into a raging fiend. So changed was he that the judge himself would not have recognized him, and the express messengers breathed with relief when they bundled him off the train in Seattle. Four men gingerly carried the crate from the wagon into swirled over, touching the ground on his back and side. He had never been struck by a club in his life. He did not understand. With a snarl that was part bark and more scream, he was again on his feet and launched into the air. Again, on Sunday, was the reply of the driver as he climbed on the wagon and started the horses. Buck's senses came back to him with God's strength. He lay where he had fallen. From there, he watched the man in the red sweater. Answers to the name of Buck. Speed. early and he was taken below by Perrault and turned over to a black-faced giant called Francois. Perrault was a French-Canadian, swarthy, but Francois was a French-Canadian half-breed, and twice as swarthy. They were a new kind of men to Buck, of which he was destined to see many more, and while he developed no affection for them, he nonetheless grew honestly to respect them. He speedily learned that Perrault and Francois were fair men, calm and impartial in administering justice, and too wise in the ways of dogs to be fooled by dogs. In the tween decks of the Narwhal, Buck and Curly joined two other dogs. One of them was a big, snow white fellow from Spitsbergen, who had been brought away by a whaling captain, and who had later accompanied the Geological Survey into the Barrens. He was friendly in a treacherous sort of way, smiling into one's face the while he meditated some underhand trick, as for instance when he stole from Buck's food at the first meal. As Buck sprang to punish him, the lash of Francois's whip sang through the air, reaching the culprit first. Nothing remained to Buck but to recover the bone. That was fair, Francois, he decided, and the half-breed began to rise in Buck's estimation. The other dog made no advances nor received any. Also, he did not attempt to steal from the newcomers. He was a gloomy, morose fellow, and he showed Curly plainly that all he desired was to be left alone, and further, that there would be trouble if he were not left alone. Dave, he was called, and he ate and slept, or yawned between times, and took interest in nothing, not even when the Narwhal crossed Queen Charlotte Sound and rolled and pitched in Buck like a thing possessed. When Buck and Curly grew excited, half wild with fear, he raised his hand as though annoyed, favored them with an incurious glance, yawned, and went to sleep again. Day and night the ship throbbed to the tireless pulse of the propeller, and though one day was very like another, it was apparent to Buck that the weather was steadily growing colder. At last, one morning, the propeller was quiet, and the Narwhal was pervaded with an atmosphere of excitement. He felt it, as did the other dogs, and knew that a change was at hand. Francois unleashed them and brought them to the deck. At the first step upon the cold surface, Buck's feet sank into a white, mushy something very like mud. He sprang back with a snort. More of this white stuff was falling through the air. He shook himself, but more of it fell upon him. He sniffed it curiously, then licked something up on his tongue. It bit like fire, and the next instant was gone. This puzzled him. He tried it again. The same result. The onlookers laughed.